We're taping today is the 25th of February. 26th of February. Thank you. We're in Potter County.
Yes.
Amarillo. We're in the offices of District Judge Abe Lopez, 108th District Court.
That's correct.
Judicial District for the state of Texas. We've gone over the material for the interview, for the archive. So I believe that you wanted to get started before the tape was on, and you started telling about your parents. So why don't we just start with some biography?
I thought it'd be easier if you didn't have to tape it. But, well, my biography, my parents are of course Hispanic, or Mexican-American, or Spanish-American, or however that word is used anymore. They're both born in the United States, although my mother was raised part of her childhood in Mexico. And came up here as a young child, born here, taken in, and brought back. my childhood is really, I remember it basically as traveling back and forth, sort of doing some type of migrant work between San Antonio, New Mexico, and La Mesa, Texas, which is just south of Lubbock. My dad was a trucker, and he would haul produce from New Mexico to the markets in San Antonio. When that season ended, then we'd go up back up to La Mesa, which is what used to be La Mesa, which is now La Mesa. And he would farm there on this farm and for a few months. And then when the harvest was in and then the summer started up again, we'd go right back into New Mexico and start all over, the process all over again. Finally, probably when I was in the third or fourth grade, he settled down in La Mesa. He decided that was what he wanted to do because he was yanking me and my brother, my younger brother and my younger sister out of school in the middle of the years and every year, school year, and thought that was kind of tough on us. So they opted to go ahead and settle there in La Mesa. And I finished my elementary school in there. And went through high school and then went to Texas Tech and received a Bachelor of Arts in History and came to Amarillo in 1970, I believe it was either late 1970 or 1971, and worked as a juvenile probation officer. It was there that I sort of had a feel for law, because I was working continuously with lawyers on a day-to-day basis with the attorneys who were appointed to represent some of the juveniles that I was assigned to try to supervise. And I got interested in law, and some of the lawyers here locally encouraged me to go to law school. And I had an acquaintance up in Washington, D.C. that was attending law school there, and he, I guess coincidentally, found out that I was here. We had gone to school together at Tech, I believe, and so he encouraged me to go, and they thought that the school loans would be very, very reasonable, and they were, so I was accepted and went to law school in Washington, D.C. And when I graduated there, I came back to Lubbock and was there for a few months. And then the local county attorney here at the time, whom I had met some years before I went to law school, had been interested in my coming to work for him in the county attorney's office as a prosecutor. And so I did, and I worked for him for about 3 years, and then I went to private practice also here. And after private practice, I was hired by a friend of mine who was elected to the district attorney's office. I became one of his prosecutors for about 4 years, and thereafter he made me his first assistant. So I was first assistant in the DA's office for about an additional 3 years. And then this position sort of came open, so I ran for it, and I was elected. It was before I went to law school that I met my wife, Dottie, and we have two sons. One's 23 years old and the other one's 17 years. One was in college up until about a year ago. He dropped out about a year ago, and that was pretty frustrating for me. And my younger one is still in high school. He's a junior in high school. And that's basically it. I got elected, and I've been here on the bench for 9 years. I just started my ninth year this past January, I've run three times, and I've run on a post the last two times, except for the time that I ran initially, which this office was filled by another judge that I ran against.
Well, I have a lot of questions. It seemed like a pretty fast, 1,000 words or less life
yeah,
story.
Well,
can we get names of parents and siblings?
Well, my mother's name is Guadalupe Lopez. Well, her maiden name was Guerra, and she married my dad, his name was Gregorio Lopez. Everybody in La Misa knew him as George Lopez. He was a farmer. On the farm, we raised cotton and sorghum, and we used to have probably one of the biggest gardens in the state of Texas. We had about 20 acres worth of tomatoes, peppers, cantaloupe, watermelon, corn. We used to grow a lot of onions. We used to grow all sorts of things in our garden. And we would give it out. My parents would give it away to people from in town, friends and relatives that would come out to the farm to visit. So.
And your brother's names? Sister?
My brother, my younger sister is Esmeralda, and her last name is Reyes. And my younger brother is Hector, of course, Lopez. He's married, has a family, lives in Oklahoma City. And my sister still lives in Lubbock. She lost her husband, Tony, about a year ago of a brain aneurysm, just died suddenly. And so he left behind three daughters and a nephew, my nephew, and three of my nieces.
So. Where in Mexico is your mother from?
You know, I don't know. And the reason I don't know is because when she was born here, she was born in, I believe, Angelina County, and was taken as a child to Mexico, and she grew up there for a few years, but she was still a minor child when she came back to the States. And she doesn't know where it was. She just knows it was somewhere in Mexico. But all my grandparents on her side, they're all gone. So there's no way we, you know, that we could find out unless she could possibly remember somehow. There's no way to find out where she was. And she doesn't remember.
Any significant memories from your early school years in La Mesa? But when were you born? Because I have no idea your
I was born
date.
In La Misa.
But
yeah.
When?
In 1943.
Well, those are difficult times in the 50s in West Texas,
yeah.
Especially
yeah.
If you were a Mexican-American.
Well, of course, I don't remember difficult times. I didn't really know that I grew up as a poor person until somebody told me I was. So we had a very good childhood. My parents were very good to us, gave us what they could with what little they had. And had a great childhood. The farm that we lived, of course, had no indoor facilities, toilets, and things of that nature. I myself was delivered on the farm, and my parents told me that the doctor came out to the farm and delivered me on the farm. So, whereas my brother and sister, they were more into the modern age, they were born in an actual hospital. So
you're the oldest?
I am the oldest, yes.
In high school, did you have anything to do with athletics or extracurricular activities of interscholastic league or debate or run for office or play football or
no,
run track? Or?
Not much of that. I played some football, and that was about it. I never was in, and I was, I think, at one time I was a member of the Spanish club, and I don't know, it's been so far back, I'm sure there was something else I would have been a member of. I was not as active as my sister was. My sister was president of the student council, I believe, when she was a senior after I left, and she was a lot more active than I was. I think there was in a graduating class of about 135 or 125, I believe, or about nine Mexicanos, eight or nine Mexicanos, as I recall, maybe more. I happened to run into my annual, and I pulled it out and I started counting some numbers. And back in those days, the Mexicanos that were graduating from high school were very, very small as compared, of course, to our Anglo friends. So,
you graduated around 62 or 63?
63. Yes.
What prompted you or who instilled in you the desire to go to college, and why Tech?
Well, Tech, of course, is just right around the corner from where I was born, where I grew up. My parents. They insisted that I go to college, and I insisted that they didn't have the money to send me to college, and they insisted we'll find a way. I had a couple of teachers, two or three teachers in high school that were very encouraging also, suggested I should go and I should at least try to go. And so I did. And once I was there, it was something that I just had to finish.
What was the extent of your parents' education?
They had no education.
At all? Second grade or third grade?
No. The only education my parents ever received, aside from like religious teachings, you know, you go to Sunday school and things of that nature, my parents went to an English class to try to learn English for about, I don't know, maybe a year, year and a half or so. And then, yeah, in English, they, you know, we call mocho, you know, just chopped up. But they could make themselves understood with anybody in town they wanted to communicate with. And they were kind of self-taught.
Well, at Tech, those were late 60s when you were at Tech, and that was the beginning of the Chicano movement, Cesar Chavez, Tijerina,
yeah,
Brown Berets in this area. Were you active in any of that, or the local organization on the campus?
We didn't have much of that. A group called the Brown Berets came in the late 60s, but by that time I was pretty well gone. I had already come down by the U and was working here. But there were some things that were being organized there. The most activities that we had, as I can remember, we had a group of Hispanics, Latinos, that we wanted to kind of share our experiences with some of the locals, people there in Lubbock. And they had a group called Los Tortulianos that was kind of the party goers, I guess is the way that word is translated. But we did some things that we set up some voter registration classes, had some meetings at one of the local churches where we invited citizens to come in, and we sort of gave them very basic lessons in how local government worked and how our overall government, federal government worked. And surprisingly, we had attendance from a lot of people that came from Mexico and some of the locals, and you know, every now and then we'd get a pretty nice turnout of people that were interested in those matters, just trying to learn so they could fit into the system and see how it worked. But that was probably the extent of any real involvement as far as any things of the Brown Berets or the Chicano movement or anything of that nature.
What prompted you to want to become a juvenile probation officer, or is that what you started out with, or that's what you ended up with?
No. I needed a job badly right out of college.
Because you were a history major.
Yeah, and I was just looking for a job, and this came over, and I'm not even sure how I found out about this job, other than I came and interviewed, and I was interviewed, went back home, and they called me and said I had the job, so then I moved up here.
Your original caseload, I guess that must have been in the early 70s?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, real early, right at 70 or 71, somewhere okay. In there.
What was that caseload like in terms of demographics? Was it mostly Hispanics, Hispanics and blacks, whites, what?
They had a policy here. We had two Mexicano officers, which included myself. We had one female officer, and the rest were Anglo male officers. And the tendency was to assign Mexicano to Mexicanos, and basically black juvenile delinquents were also assigned to myself or Marion Gowna was the other officer, and the female officer received got all the female juvenile probationers, and then the other two fellows got the Anglo officers got just the Anglo juvenile probationers. That was basically how it was set up.
And in terms of numbers, in terms of offenders, I guess what I'm asking is, do we have a greater problem of juvenile delinquency among Hispanics today than we did back in 70, 71? Or is it a function of the numbers that have increased in this area?
I think it's just a function of the numbers that have increased. I don't think it's any, proportionally, I think it's basically the same as it was back then. The caseloads have increased generally overall. We have more officers now in that department than we did back then. Back then we had six officers, now we have probably 16 or 17. And recently hired two more.
Do you remember an incident or an experience or an observation of one day where you said, I'm going to be a lawyer, by God?
Well, I was in I took a lot of pride in trying to really supervise the kids that I was supervising back in those days. Because if you lost a kid, you lost him to the Texas Youth Council. In other words, they were incarcerated. It's kind of like the little prison of kids as compared to the prison system for adults, the prison system of the state of Texas. And my goal was to see that none of my kids were ever revoked, their probation is revoked or sent to TYC. But as hard as you try, you would always lose some. And I lost some. But one I had was a kid that I don't think he was even Hispanic or Mexicano. He was just a kid that just had a lot of problems, and he of course had a lawyer, and he really refused to admit that what he had done was wrong. So he was entitled to a jury trial, and the attorneys in that case had me inside the rail where the attorney sit. I wasn't necessarily a witness that took the witness stand to testify. I wasn't necessarily part of the audience, so I was outside. They, for some reason, and I'm not even remember why anymore, but they had me in within where the lawyers were all for the defense attorney who was for the child, and the prosecutors who were from the county attorney's office. They had me inside there for whatever reasons that I don't recall anymore. And I saw actually firsthand a trial from its inception to its conclusion. And I really felt like the things that they were doing was something that I could do, because it involved dealing with people, which I had done. I had worked my way through Texas Tech, working in a community center and working at car washes and pumping gas and things of that nature. So you dealt with people, and you were dealing with law, which I thought was very interesting and very fascinating. Why can they do this and they can't do that, and vice versa? Those are the things that interest me. And although I had questioned those things before, I think it was that one trial that really led me to believe that I think I can do this if I have the opportunity. And from that time on, I started kind of looking around and questioning, and then lawyers, again, as I indicated earlier, began to encourage me to do that. So that, I think that would have been the moment that I decided that I would like to do that.
Who was the buddy that recruited you to, was it Georgetown Law School?
It was George Washington.
George Washington.
Mm-hmm. There was a fellow by the name of Wilson Salinas who was an attorney in Lubbock.
Nelson?
Wilson.
Wilson?
Yeah, Salinas, I don't know.
That's the strange first name,
yeah.
Wilson.
Yeah, he's a Mexican.
Okay.
And the thing that was really positive about the school was because they had the finance, and it was just so incredibly cheap. And since I'd already married my wife, the opportunities there for her to work, so she could work, help me put my way through school, were just incredibly better than anything here. Her salary, based on the job she had here, as opposed to there, was like more than three times. And so, we felt that it was something we could do financially. And the scariest part was just moving up there without any jobs except for hers. Because I had lived in California for two or three months, just kind of being a beach bum right after college. And I had traveled before, you know, within the United States, so.
As a migrant, is that what you mean, or?
No, this was after college.
Where'd you go, some of the places you've gone to?
Well, I had been to New Mexico, I had been to Colorado, I had been to California. Some in Oklahoma, just close by. I've been down to South Texas quite a few times. Traveled to Mexico once or twice.
Just touring? Or just
yeah, just
vacations?
Yeah, this was when I was in college, when you had a spring break or something like that, a bunch of guys would get together and go. But right out of college, I actually moved to California and lived there for about 2 months.
Where?
In Redondo Beach. Mm-hmm. And stayed there for two or three months, I believe. And I said I was a beach bum. I had a small apartment near the beach, but I was working for, I believe I worked for Rockwell as one of their maintenance guys. I made sure that all the water came on at the right time on their humongous lawns. They had lawns that constituted football, you know, four or five football fields just as part of their lawns in front of some of their buildings that were just so huge. But I did some of that, and then came back and decided I needed to work.
Well, tell me a little bit about Dottie. Where did you meet her? Why did you decide to marry her?
Well, I met her here in Amarillo a few months after I moved here in late 70 or 71. And I had moved in with some guys that I, one guy had gone to Tech, and he was rooming with another fellow who was a friend of his who was from, I believe, Hereford or Dimmitt somewhere. And they were looking for a roommate, so I moved in with him. And then my wife lived down the apartment complex just a few doors down with some other girls, and we just kind of met there. Initially I met her, we had gone out to eat one morning at a breakfast, and I went out with my roommates, and she and her roommates were at the same place having breakfast, and they just kind of saw each other. And that was when we first met initially. And then I found out that she lived in the same complex, so we saw each other a few more times. And after several months, we decided to get married. And, she was kind of a military brat, but not necessarily a military brat. Her father worked as a civil servant for the Air Force, and he was transferred from base to base as a base instructor, a fields instructor. And so she was with him, and so he wasn't really an enlisted person, but he worked for the government as an enlisted as a civilian person.
So I guess, well, where's she from, or what are her your in-laws, and who are these people?
She was born in Rantoul, Illinois.
Rantoul. You know how to spell that?
R-A-N-T-O-U-L.
Okay.
There's a base up there where she was born. And she has no brothers or sisters. She has a half-brother, Bill, who lived in California, and he passed away a couple of years ago. Her dad passed away 2 years ago, and her mom passed away about 10 years ago. So she's the only person that's left, you know.
What are your kids' names?
The oldest boy is Andy, and the youngest is Danny.
Two boys?
Two boys.
Okay. Well, getting back to law school, was it culture shock for you and your wife to show up in Washington, D.C., predominantly black and urban, certainly much more populated than Amarillo or Lubbock together ever were?
No, not really. We got the worst problem I had with D.C. was the traffic. Just horrible, horrible traffic. But no, it wasn't a shock. I adjusted pretty quickly to it.
How about the actual student body and your colleagues and your peers?
There were some strange people there that I had never seen before. There were Jews. I'd never known a Jew before. And there were great people. They had no questions about who I was. They just accepted you. Because the majority of, as I recall, majority of the students here were Jewish students. And a lot, GW was sort of a night school for a lot of government employees that were full-time employees with the federal government, and then worked at night. I mean, went to school at night to earn their law degrees. But a lot of the students were Jewish students, and there were a lot of black students there too. But they were like from the East Coast, and they didn't see any differences between as to who I was. And some people, some of the Jewish students that I met there that became good friends with, were just as curious about me as I was about them. And I learned some about their Jewish faith and their culture, and they learned from me, because we used to get together with some of them, and at least in one particular couple that we grew to be close, that we spent a lot of time with each other in our home and their home, and trying their meals, and they were trying our meals, and things of that nature. So that was about the only thing that I saw that was kind of different, just a different culture that I had not been exposed to before.
Was the plan always to come back to Lubbock or to Amarillo?
No, I don't know if I had any plans. I kind of wanted to stay in Washington and work there. And I think Dottie did too, but my family was here and her mother was still alive here. Her parents were divorced at that time. And Jack was still in Rantoul.
Is that the father?
Yes, and her father. And so I think it was more having being close to the family, the parents that brought us back here, back to this area anyway.
Well, tell me if you can, in two kind of statements, what was it like being county attorney, prosecutor, and district attorney, prosecutor, the comparative nature of that, and then the other part is the interplay of politics, because the actual county attorney, district attorney are elective offices,
right?
Not the hired prosecutors. There must be some tensions there, or some kind of a relationship or respect where you not deal with the politics, but you must recognize the politics.
Well, they're two completely and totally different offices. The county attorney, being a lawyer as you well know, handles misdemeanor cases here in Potter County. And the fellow that was a county attorney at the time was just an incredibly nice fellow. And I had met him when I was a juvenile officer, and he was one of the guys that encouraged me to go to law school. And he had even told me before, he said, when you get back, you have a job here, I'm going to hire you when you get back. And in fact, he did.
Were you among the first Mexican-Americans, or the first?
I think I was the first.
Who's this guy's name?
Kerry Norp. He was a county attorney.
Norp.
K-N-O-R-P-P.
Okay.
Kerry Norp. And as far as I know, yes. I was the first, as far as I know. And I worked for him for about, I believe, 3 years. And then I had some friends out in the community that were lawyers and offered me a pay raise and more money and if I would go work for them in this law firm in private practice. They would give me a salary, and then I would have, we had some kind of an agreement, they would pay me commissions or I'd receive commissions, and they would give me some type of salary also. And I did that, and then when I came back about a couple of years later, another friend of mine that I had met some time before, by the name of Danny Hill, ran for office as a district attorney. And politics back in those days were pretty nasty around here, as far as, and especially with that particular office, there have been some things that had happened in the past that had kind of divided the county. But anyhow, Danny ran in a race and got elected. And because of the things that had happened before within that office, when he took office, he just more or less cleaned house. And so he had lined up some prosecutors to come in from Houston and local people that he felt that he could work well with and trust. And he had some people lined up so that the minute he took office, he brought his people in. But he was still shorthanded as far as prosecutors was concerned. So he started started recruiting me, and for three or four months I refused. I didn't want to. And finally, he convinced me that I should go prosecute and be in his office. And again, as far as I know, I was the first Hispanic to work in that office as a prosecutor.
And of course, now you're in felony court.
Yeah, I'm felony court, yes. So. Mm-hmm.
Your personal observations about the nature of the work or the challenge of the work, and misdemeanors and felonies, what's at stake?
Misdemeanors,
what goes wrong?
As a prosecutor, misdemeanors were very simple cases to try because there's not that much at stake. Most of the offenses and cases that you handle were fine only. Some involved jail time. As opposed to felonies, when I prosecuted felonies, you were dealing with people's lives, and you're talking about homicides, robberies, aggravated assault, sexual assaults, burglaries of your homes, and things of that nature. They were more serious offenses, and I took them more seriously, and I thought I prosecuted those cases when I was assigned to court. I thought I prosecuted them vigorously. So I feel that I was properly trained, starting from the minute I came to Amarillo, to be able to handle this job. And even though it's more serious, it's like anything else. The more you do it, the more comfortable you feel in it. But it's still a very serious position because of some of the things that come through your court, that such as these felonies that we're talking about, you're really dealing with people's lives. That's not only affects that particular individual, but it really also affects the immediate families and those individuals when they lose their dad or their mom to the penitentiary for years, and there's minor children involved because that person went out and killed someone or robbed someone or raped someone. You know, those are things that are hard to deal with. But, you know, you just kind of try to take it in stride and do what you have to do and just go on to the next case, because for every case you get rid of, you wind up 2-3 more.
How many death penalty cases did you do?
As a judge or as a prosecutor?
Prosecutor.
As a prosecutor, I handled, I believe, one. Assisted in one. Maybe two. I think just one.
How do you feel about that? The death penalty?
Death penalty? I have some emotions against the death penalty, but I think that in any given case, any proper case, it's warranted. As a judge, I've sat as a judge in two death penalty cases. One person has already been executed, the other one is pending death row, and his could conceivably be completed or concluded within the next year or so, I think.
Well, we're almost at the district judge race. What prompted you to switch and become a politician and say, or was it that at all? Or did you say, I just want to be the judge, and if it takes from running, because I'll have to do that. When did that get into your mind?
I don't know. It was proposed to me several times. When I was here, my friend Kerry Norf, who was a county attorney, he had some legal problems and he left office. And county commissioners have the authority to appoint an interim county attorney or a regular county attorney until the next election. And when that happened, there was a vacancy. Some people were appointed, and those that were decided there was time for them to leave. And at one point in time, I had been offered that position as an assistant county attorney, as a county attorney, when I was in the DA's office as a prosecutor. And I didn't feel like that was what I wanted to do at that time. I felt safe where I was as an assistant prosecutor for the DA's office. Even though it would have meant more pay and I would have been head of an office at that time, I just decided that I didn't want to do that. So when I was prosecuting in the district attorney's office, the court that I was assigned to deal with on a day-to-day basis and handle was this very same court that I'm sitting in now. And Judge Ed Nobles was the presiding judge at that time. And he had been the judge here for several years before I came to the DA's office. And I had practiced in his court when I was in private practice. And even as a county assistant county attorney, I had practiced in his court, had some cases in his court that by necessity had to be filed through the county attorney's office. So Judge Nobles called me in one day and said, listen, and after I've been prosecuting in this court for about 3 years, and then I became first assistant, he was still the judge. And one day he called me down and said, look, I'm going to announce my retirement. And the only people that know are my staff and my wife and a few other close friends. But I need you to know this because I want you to apply for it, because this is a governor appointment position. There's a vacancy created, and you need to try to get this position if at all possible. Well, of course, that made me feel pretty good that he had a confidence in me to apply for this job. And so I said, well, I'll think about it. So then he made his announcement, and of course, lots of people were interested in the job, and lots of people filed applications with the governor's office. The governor at that time was Bill, Governor Clements. So after, I think Judge Nobles left office in, I believe in March, and up until through that August, the position had not been filled. All these months, several people were filing applications, several lawyers, were sending applications into the governor's office, and they received mine. I had people come out of the woodwork sending letters on my behalf to the governor. And, of course, Governor Clements was a Republican, and he had made no bones about the fact that if any vacancies throughout the state ever came up, because this was the second go-round in the office, having been defeated before by, I believe, Mark White, that he would not appoint any Democrats to any offices. And so I knew that I didn't have much of a chance. But anyhow, I was really surprised that he was kind enough to send me an invitation to meet with his secretary, the appointment secretary. And I went to the interview. I flew down to Austin, and did not get to really interview with the appointment secretary, but I was able to interview with some person below him. And so I spent probably 30 minutes there with him, and the interview, and he said, okay, we'll kind of take it under advisement. So I came back to Amarillo, and he gave the appointment to a fellow that got to be, he and I got to be, you know, acquaintances, who was a trust officer at one of the local banks, and had for the past 8 years had not been in a courtroom, had not done much of anything, but he was a Republican, and that's what he wanted in there.
Who was that?
And then a fellow by the name of Gerald Dowell.
D-O-W-L?
Yes, that D-A, yeah, huh? And so he got the appointment. And I kind of knew what was going to happen. I wasn't all that disappointed, although I have to admit that I kind of really was, because I thought I had more experience than he did. So anyhow, things rocked along for a while. And it just so happens that when Judge Nobles left this office and Judge Dowell got the appointment, there were only a few months left in that particular term, and Judge Dowell was going to have to run again. And so I had a lot of people call me and ask me to run and at least give the people of Potter County a choice between Judge Dowell and myself. And as time progressed, we had a lot of support, got a little bit of money together, not a whole lot. And so on the filing deadline, I went ahead and threw in my application.
How many Mexican-American voters are there in this county?
Well, the population is probably about 18% Hispanic, but probably only about maybe 7 or 8% are registered voters, actually, I would say.
So it's pretty safe to say that you weren't elected by Mexican American.
Well, probably so. I would think that for those that hadn't voted many years, they went out and voted that particular time.
What about African Americans? How many are there in Potter County?
The percentages are smaller than that. I'm not exactly sure what they are, but they're a little bit smaller than Hispanic.
So minority voters are about 10, 11% of the Potter County's population?
Probably registered voters, yeah, 12% maybe total.
Mm-hmm. Now, excuse me.
Go ahead.
This district, there's three judicial districts here at least, no? One that covers three counties?
One covers three counties.
47?
47.
And then yours only covers Potter County?
Potter County. And then the other four also cover Potter and Randall. I'm sorry, the other three cover Potter and Randall.
So for election purposes, you're like countywide only?
Only countywide, yes. Just Potter County.
And you were the first Mexican-American in the entire panhandle, probably in all of...
As far as I know, yes.
Did anyone ever raise that issue, or did you have doubts about that, that it might be a problem?
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about it?
Well, you know, it was an uphill fight, of course. It was very difficult for us to raise any money. People would not come out and support you publicly. I was running against an incumbent who was a Republican. I was running in a year where President Bush was running against Dukakis.
So this is 88?
1988. Democrats were not really in favor with anyone, anywhere in the country at that time. And it was just a situation where really nobody gave us much of a chance. And there was a lot of interest in the presidential race that year. And all the other district courts and the county courts of law in Potter County and Randall and Austin, this three county district, they all run on governing years. And this court's the only one that runs on presidential years. So I was the only guy out there running for office, and it was not an easy, you know, job to go out there and recruit votes from anybody at that time. So we said, well, you know, we're in it, we filed, and we don't have much money, but we got some people that really decided they wanted to work for us. And we had a handful of about, 12, 14, 20 people. Some did a lot, some did as much as they could. We had a few fundraisers that people put together, a little dinner here and there, pay, and we'd pay the caterers, and people would do a potluck dinner for us. And we raised enough money to at least run a dozen or so TV commercials. That's all we could afford. And couldn't afford any newspaper advertising at all. We decided, some of the people that were helping me decided the TV commercials would at least reach everybody possibly, whereas a newspaper may only reach people in the south and southwest of Potter County and not necessarily on the east side where the Hispanic population is, or the north side of town where the black population is. So we opted to go with spend our money with TV advertising. And then we did one or two limited letter campaigns, sending letters out, which were a total fiasco. We sent out, I don't know how many hundreds, maybe close to 1,000 letters with brochures and pamphlets like the one I just gave you, and a little card asking for a dollar to whatever they could afford. And we raised probably, I'm not sure that even we recovered our cost from the donor contributions on that. But there was one letter that I got from a lady. I still have that letter. It was a senior citizen lady who was, I believe she was like 72 or 73 years old and retired. And the language of the letter said something like, I'm not exactly sure, but I'm retired. I'm on limited income, fixed income, Social Security. She sent me a dollar because that's all she could afford, you. And so, you know, it all turned out pretty good.
Did you have Democratic Party opposition?
No.
Okay. Did he have Republican Party opposition?
Mm-hmm.
So you really just all went through the motions to get to November.
Uh-huh. The primaries, we were just unopposed, and in November, it was just he and I.
Is this basically Republican country?
It didn't used to be up until probably, I'd say 12 years ago, things started changing.
Well, that's 88.
Well, yeah, about that time, I would say, yeah. A little before that, 88.
So did you win handily or barely, or?
As I recall the numbers, I won by a little over 2,000 votes.
Is that a good margin, or
that was a great margin?
It was a great margin.
Yeah, for the race that we ran, it was a tremendous margin.
Why do you think you won?
Well, for the reasons that are stated in that pamphlet, when I came to Amarillo, I did a lot of volunteer work. I served on the board of the YMCA. Mental health, mental retardation, all sorts of things like that. I coached Kids Incorporated. I was on the board at the Wesley Community Center, which is a Methodist organization which provides outreach services for the Hispanic community. I coached their teams over there. I coached my team, my son's team, my older boys' team over in my side, in the other side of him at Avondale Elementary School. So throughout the years, I think I had a lot of exposure. And I really feel that even those people that that would not openly support me because maybe of who I was and the fact that I was running as a Democrat, really told, you know, maybe told us how they really felt at the ballot box. And because the boxes that were traditionally Republican boxes, strong Republican boxes, I think we lost three of them by, I think we lost one box by three votes or five votes. We won the other one by about three votes. Those big boxes more or less canceled themselves out. The real major Republican box, I lost by, I think, 300 votes or something like that, which I expected to lose by 1,000 or more. The black box went completely and totally for us, basically, except for maybe 30 votes or so, or 80 votes or something like that. We got about 1,100 votes out of that box, I believe. The Hispanic community, all on the east side and north side, west side, east side of Amarillo, they came in very, very strong. So I was real lucky and glad to know that I had the kind of support that really wasn't visible on the surface, but I think it was just there. And I think based on the fact that I've been involved in the community, whereas my opponent had not, he didn't have really the experience in the field, in the legal field, hadn't for the last 8 years, whereas I had. I think that had a lot to do with it.
So how much money did you end up spending or raising and spending?
You know, I really can't recall anymore, but it was somewhere around 10 or 12 thousand, and my opponent had almost three times that much.
You put money out of your own pocket?
Yeah, we put money out of our own pocket. Huh?
But how much did you have to invest?
I don't remember. But what was really curious is after the election, I got a lot of money.
So you were able to pay yourself back?
Yeah, we paid ourselves back, and we had a surplus. And as a matter of fact, that surplus is still at the bank in a CD earning interest, so in case we have to ever run again.
Because you've been unopposed since then?
Yeah.
Are you running now? No.
No, I just, because I'm
you're not in the middle of your second term.
I just started my first year out of my next 4 years. In January.
Right.
So I run again when the presidential elections come up here.
Okay. Well, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but did I understand you to say that your candidacy increased the voter turnout in the Mexican-American community?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Were there or are there other Mexican-American elected officials, and did you all work in tandem? Did you all meet to talk about this?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. I think that I had the support of every Hispanic leader, business leader, every Hispanic, whether they were Republican business people, Hispanic Republican businessmen or not, I think they supported me. And there were some black leaders, elected leaders. Elijah Demerson was a black our county judge at that time. He was a Democrat, and he gave me his support. Morris Overstreet, who's running for Attorney General, who's now on the Court of Criminal Appeals. At that time, he was a county court of law judge. I met with him. He gave me his support. Manny Pettis, who is one of our local commissioners, he's a commissioner from one of our precincts here. He worked very hard for me, put out signs for me, worked real hard. So those are the three individuals at the time that were minority office holders, elected office holders, that got behind me. And I walked a lot of miles. I think I knocked on about 90% of the doors in Potter County. And if I didn't knock on them, my two sons knocked on them, handed brochures. My wife did. I'm even thinking that I had some relatives come in and knock on doors for me from out of town. And, you know, we had a lot of support. Lubbock. I had a good friend there by the name of Tomas Garza, who was an attorney in Lubbock, and my brother-in-law, Tony, my sister's husband, and my sister, and some other friends, I think Eliseo Solis, and some other guys that I know, they had a fundraiser for me in Lubbock that I went to, and they had a dinner. We raised enough money to help us do, you know, a second mail-out. Wasn't a whole lot of money, but it was just the thought that counted. You know.
Now, for judicial races, there's special rules that apply to raising money. Can you talk a little bit about that, as to how you're handicapped as opposed to other politicians?
Well, back then, we were not. It was pretty well wide open, just like any other candidate. Now we're restricted, and we can only raise money within a certain time frame. For example, I think that if you're running, and I can't recall the days right now, the dates, but if you're running in a primary and if you're opposed, I think you can start raising money like in January, and then you can raise money up to a certain time, and then you have to stop, and you have to start over again. So there's only a certain time frame. And then if you're just running in the general, I think you can only raise money. Again, there's a time window that the legislature has set up for us. I'm not really sure what those days are, and I haven't looked at it for a while.
Okay.
And also the amount of money you can raise. And if you're going to raise over like $100,000, you have to send in some kind of a waiver saying that you're going to raise more than that.
This Black County judge that you talked about, his last name is Demers?
Demerson.
How do you spell it?
D-E-M-E-R-S-O-N.
You know, this Potter County is unusual. To elect Abe Lopez, Morris Overstreet, Demerson County Judge, when those populations are not evident. So in a way, it's almost like they're liberals. How do you explain this?
I think we have a lot of people in Potter County and Amarillo in general that I think they look at the individual and what their platforms are for the city or for the county, because we even had a Hispanic city commissioner.
Is he now at it?
Who was elected at large, so he wasn't running for any particular district or precinct. He was elected at large, and Zeke was our first Hispanic city commissioner, and like they did with me, and he did with me. I did with him when he ran for city commission. We helped him as much as we could. It seemed like it was one of those deals where you just kind of got behind your candidate and just did everything they could to raise money and just garner support for the candidate's sake.
Well, speaking now about being district judge, what's the challenge? What's the struggle? What's the best thing about it? What's the worst thing about it?
The worst part about it is the high rate of crime and the fact that you see these cases come through on a daily basis, and then when you look behind that crime, you see that it's that about 80% to 90% of it is related in some form or fashion to the use of drugs, and that's what's really scary. Whether it's you're either stealing to money to buy drugs with, or you're stealing property to exchange or pawn it off to get money to buy drugs with, or steal things to just exchange for drugs. It seems to be the thing that is most prevalent in the cases that we handle. If you're burglarizing, breaking into cars or homes, the same thing. You may get charged with a burglary, but the underlying problem with that individual is he or she has a drug problem and they're just trying to get money for drugs or steal property to exchange for drugs. That to me is the worst. And of course in this business, you don't make everybody happy. One side wins and one side loses when you're dealing with civil cases, accidents, and job injuries and things of that nature, and some of those things are by and far I don't have much input into those because most of those cases are tried before a jury, and I think our jurors in Potter County are very, very reasonable people. They I think they can see whether an injury is really an injury or an injury is not an injury. And I think they compensate litigants based on the facts of their case, whether it's a strong case or not, whether the injuries are real or not. And I've been around long enough as in private practice and as a prosecutor and as a judge to see the cases that I think merit some damages and those that don't. And by and for, I think the juries have been able to read the facts and read them fairly and give those people that really deserve some money for their injuries the money they deserve, and those that really don't, not get anything or very little. We do some family law. That's almost as bad sometimes, and maybe even worse in criminal cases, because you see families being torn apart, children being torn apart. Who do they live with? Mom is leaving town or daddy's leaving town. They don't get seen anymore. Dads, they don't pay their child support. When mom is trying to struggle, trying to get by on her salary and can't do it anymore. Having to put people in jail because they don't pay their child support. There's really very few things that you do here that really are very pleasant, of course, as you well know as an attorney. But every now and then you get some cases that are just adoptions, that a baby or a young child gets a new set of parents, and those are fun to do. So
clearly there's no family law court here in Potter County yet, or in this area, designated as such. You have to handle all of that.
Yeah, we have Judge Emerson, the 320th, was up until before there was a reorganization of and consolidating courts instead of having domestic relations courts and district courts. Judge Emerson's court was the domestic relations court, primarily responsible for all family law matters. And when they had this reorganization and they met all those courts, just regular district courts, Judge Emerson's language in the legislation that changed his court from a family court or domestic relations court to a district court, he was still held primarily responsible for all family law matters. But he didn't want to just do that. He wanted to have his hand in civil matters and criminal matters. So we sort of kind of have an informal agreement between him and the other courts that he would give us some family law if he wanted it, which I did, and we would give him some of the civil cases, some of the criminal law cases that he could handle, just to kind of keep some diversity going in his court. And I kind of wanted to hand him some family law to kind of stay up with the law.
How does a district judge keep up with all of the different kinds of cases that come? I know the assumption is that if you're a lawyer, you know everything there is to know about the law.
Yeah.
But we know better.
That's true.
And judges are not exempt from that either. But
no,
how, what do you do to keep up with all of this? Or do you push the lawyers to give you the opposing side so that they teach you in a way?
There was a time when, if you look at that stack there behind you and the one over here in this bookcase and all these stacks right here, where I would get these publications and I would have time to read them. I'd take them home and read them at night. But as you can see, these stacks are stacks that hopefully I'll get to someday, but some of those are from 1996 already, and I'll never get to read them. So you're put in a posture anymore of when you have a particular legal question arise in a particular case, I just have first of all, you pretty well have an idea. If you've been around long enough, you pretty well have an idea what the theory is and on what basis that theory is being proceeded on. But sometimes when the lawyers are so close, you ask them, well, you know, I need you to find me some cases in this area and provide me with legal briefs, which is what I do as a matter of course now. And when they cite me those cases, I've had them cite the same case for the same proposition for diametrically opposed sides. And when they do that, I just I'll go to the books myself, which I have here, and I'll pull the case, and I'll read the case once, twice, sometimes as many as 10 times if I have to see where that case fits in their particular PAC situation so I can make a proper ruling. So you're right, you just cannot, I mean, it's just so voluminous anymore, you just can't keep up with it anymore.
How much time do you spend a week on all of this?
Every chance I get.
50 hours, 60 hours, 70 hours?
Probably not 60 hours, but at least a good 50 hours. I come in on weekends sometimes, on Saturday mornings, when things are quiet at my house, and I'll come in and I'll be a couple hours, 2 or 3 hours. There's times when I come in at night during the week. I spend probably, on an average, a week, I would say about 3 hours during the noon hour. For example, this noon hour, I spend in the office reading. Because it's quiet, the phone doesn't ring as much, my staff is gone, and so I use that time as a quiet time to catch up on reading.
What kind of staff do you get, particularly legal support?
We have no type of legal support with district courts in the state of Texas. All we get is a court coordinator who answers the phone and schedules hearings for you. We have a bailiff who is sort of a courtroom security person, and then a court reporter who takes the proceedings as we hear them in the courtroom, whether they're trials or non-jury matters.
Do you get to pick any of those people, or that's civil service?
No, you get to pick those people. You have to post a position for people that are interested, and then you interview and you try to select the person that you feel is best qualified.
What's the salary now?
For court coordinators, it's right about, they just had a recent pay increase, about $28,000. Court reporters are about $35,000, pretty close to $40,000, maybe closer to $40,000 and $35,000. And the bailiff is at about pretty close to $22,000.
And the judge?
I'm not sure that I can tell you that, but it's somewhere between 90, 92. We just had a pay increase also. That went into effect, I believe, in September.
Is there a differential between the other judges and yourself?
No, because it's all state paid. Well, I take that back. Some of the judges that have other counties, additional counties, get a little supplement.
Travel?
Yeah, for travel. It may be $1,000, $2,000 a year more. So it's a little higher than in this position.
Any future position you're interested in?
No.
Any appointment you're interested in?
No.
Any appointment you would turn down?
Well, I haven't been offered any yet, so I haven't had a chance to turn any down. But I'm very comfortable here. I like, you know, if you can just set aside those matters to deal with the problems of, sometimes it gets very discouraging here, doing what you do. If you can just get by that and just put it aside and just go on to the next matter, because you really can't let those things grate on you, otherwise you just develop an ulcer and you go crazy around here. So if you can learn to handle that situation, I feel comfortable here. I think I do good work, and I feel confident that I'm doing well and that I administer justice as well as I can based on the facts and based on the law that's presented to me on the cases that come before me.
Can poor people get justice?
Yeah, I think so.
Is there a public defender program here, or a system of court appointments?
We have a system of court appointments. The attorneys that I appoint to handle my criminal cases are handpicked by me. I've known most of them since I was a prosecutor, or I was in private practice. I know their capabilities. I know their strong points. I know their weak points. And I handpick oftentimes a particular defense attorney for a particular case that has a particular problem. For civil matters, we have a legal aid office that people can go to. We have toyed with the idea of contracting with private attorneys for them to handle the criminal cases, the indigent cases that come through. That may happen sometime in the future. And of course, we also appoint lawyers on family cases when there's a possibility that a dad may go to jail or something like that. We also appoint lawyers as ad litems for children when they need lawyers. So I feel very comfortable with the quality of legal services that our ad litems, our attorneys here, provide for us, not for me, but to the people that I appointed to. when there's a necessity for a court-appointed lawyer.
Switching over to the last part of the interview, I only got about 5 or 6 questions more. Who is the most effective political leader in the Mexican-American community today, at whatever level?
You mean statewide or?
At whatever level. If you have somebody in mind statewide, or national, or local, or regional?
I think Dan Morales.
Of course, he's taking himself out.
I know.
But you think that's temporary? Or?
Well, I hate to see him go because I thought he was a good public servant. You know, you can really criticize anybody for what they do. And you, again, as I said earlier, in this job, you can't please everybody. But I think he did the best he could with what he had, and has done a good job for Texas.
You agree with him on the Hopwood decision?
To some extent, yes. Yeah.
Do you agree on the attorney fee settlements in the tobacco case?
Not necessarily, no.
Do you agree with the Oprah Winfrey verdict across the street today?
I'm not sure what the verdict was.
She won. The case got thrown out.
I'm sure they had all the facts, and I'm sure they did what they had to do.
What is the most effective, or which is the most effective political organization among the Mexican community today?
Political?
Well, I'd use the word effective.
Effective?
I didn't want to pigeonhole, because there's all different kinds of groups out there.
I think our Hispanic chambers have been very effective. Because when they go up and rub elbows with other Hispanic, with other chambers of commerce, in whatever cities they are, not only are they promoting their own businesses, but I think they're promoting the Hispanic population as a whole. They're exposing their businesses to the community, whereas they might not otherwise do so. And I think the Anglo community, if they're receptive to a Hispanic chamber like they have here in Amarillo, I think they along in their own ways help the Hispanic chamber. So they have sort of a camaraderie there that they help each other out. In that sense, I think it helps the Hispanic community as a whole overall.
I know that you, in your remarks, you have alluded to relationship with the African-American community here in town, and individuals you've identified as collaborating with. But my question is, what are the underpinnings of tension between blacks and browns here in Amarillo?
I don't think there is any.
Well, what are the underpinnings of good relations? What's the ingredient to have good relations and working together?
Well, there's several blacks and Hispanics that serve on certain boards together. I've served with blacks and Anglos and other Hispanics on boards together. And by and far, I think that they are looking for a common goal, and that is what's good for the community overall. And I don't think that I've ever seen since I've been here. Of course, you're always going to have maybe something that arises that might have a tendency to create tensions between blacks and browns, but I don't recall of any instance in the last, since I've been here since 75, that created that kind of a rift between the blacks and browns that's even worth mentioning. I know that in Los Barrios, which is a local, very effective Hispanic organization here in town that's comprised of blue-collar workers and white-collar workers, that and it's primarily Hispanic, that meets in the Hispanic side of town, and that several agencies come to for advice and consent on matters, that there's some blacks that are involved in that organization, and vice versa. So I think the relations between brown and black in this community are good, and I get calls from black friends that I know. I had one last week, and if I ever have a question about something that's going on over there, I have no problems in picking up the phone and calling someone like an Emerson or an Iris Lawrence or a Will Burrowkill, who was one of our black county commissioners at the time. Iris Lawrence is real active with the Democratic Party, and she's running for the, one of the county commission positions. So it's, I don't see if that's a problem, and has been. I just don't recall of anything being of a serious nature.
Chicano and Mexicano relations. I'm talking about people from Mexico and people born here. What ought the relations be like, and what are they like in this area?
I think they're okay. I think a few years ago, when people from Mexico started coming in, they started opening their own businesses, and you could see that there was some talk around town. You could hear it, the rumors and things of that nature. But I think it's been positive, because I know of several local people that have opened up their own businesses within the last few years. I think for the reason that they say, hey, well, these people from Mexico came in, they opened up a restaurant or they opened up a bridal shop or whatever, why can't I? And I've seen them open up their own business, people that have been here for a long time. They were not in business before, and now are. They may have their own Mexican restaurant. And I think it's been a positive deal for everybody.
What's the most pressing issue facing Mexican Americans today?
Well, at one time I would have said, the dropout problem. I mean, that has to be the by and far the largest, and a very, very close second, and maybe even ahead of that is just the high pregnancy rate of our Chicana girls, Mexicana girls. And I think that's in conjunction with the dropout. In that particular gender, the female dropout pregnancy, the male just dropouts.
Two more questions. One, what is leadership?
Well, from my perspective, leadership is being able to set some goals that are needed and organize some support to identify those goals and get people, get that support to agree with you that this is a goal that needs to be addressed and some solution for it if there's a problem with that particular goal. And if you have to take the lead, but if there's someone else that wants to lead, let them go ahead and do it. To me, as long as we get there, I don't care who takes you there or who gets you there or how they get you there, as long as it's by legal means. And to me, leadership is, if someone else wants to take credit, you know, go ahead and do it. Let them have it. Don't miss an opportunity to do something positive for the community by trying to wreck it, because you're not going to get the credit or you're not going to be recognized as a person who got it started or finished it or did all the work and things of that nature.
What's going to happen in politics here in the next 10, 20 years in terms of Mexican Americans?
Well, with the population growth as it continues to explode, I think that if citizens continue to come into this area and become citizens and become knowledgeable in our system of government, that we'll probably be in a situation where my hometown of Lomisa is now, I think they're about like 50-50. I can envision that happening here in the next year or two, within the next 10 or 20 years or so, possibly. Maybe not 50-50, but pretty close to maybe 30 or 35, and then with blacks, of course, they'll be increasing in percentages too, so there'll be a lot more Hispanics in this area, a lot more.
The question is
not whether you're just increasing population, or are there going to be citizens that are taking the responsibility of voting and looking at the issues and making wise and independent decisions that they have to make our system continue to work as we know it today.
I don't have any further questions. Is there a comment you want to make or an area you want to revisit, your childhood or your biography or your career or your views on the judgeship? Anything that you want to add as we close this?
None other than there's been a lot of people that supported me in my campaign when I didn't think that, you know, we had a chance. The funny thing about that is that I never felt that I was going to lose. I always had positive thoughts about it. But, you know, you never really know. And until the box is closed and the election returns came in, and you saw the numbers of the individual boxes that you never thought you could even carry, because I think it were 27 boxes or so. I think we won all of them, but about four or five. It just made me realize that, you know, if I could pull this off, any other Mexicano can, or any other black can. But you have to have the training. You have to know what you're doing. You have to do the research. You have to understand the issues. And before you go out and attempt to do something, because there's going to be a lot of people that are going to question you on what your motives are, how does all this fit in what you're trying to do, and if you're not prepared to answer those questions, you're not going to get the support that you want. And so, if you want to accomplish something, if you want to be a judge or a lawyer, you need a good, strong educational background. And where do you start? Well, you start at elementary school. And we try real hard here in Amarillo to, we have a host program, we have a lot of mentoring programs, we try to help our Hispanic community, the little kids, to mentor them, stay away from drugs, and get an education, actively involved in the Stepped Up to Success program through Los Barrios and the Westland Community Center. We have a career day for our middle schools and our high school, bringing our kids to, and we have a battery of speakers, 30, 40 speakers, mainly all Hispanic, from different walks of life that operate here in Amarillo. And it's a very strong, united group of individuals that will speak to these kids anywhere you want, from lawyering to insurance, banking. We get them all. Curiously, a couple of years ago, and at the end of those sessions, we ask our students to fill out a form what they thought of our speakers and are there any other fields that they would be interested in learning about, or firemen or whatever. And we had a little slip of paper that we were trying, and somebody, a girl, was interested in becoming a nun. So the following year, we had the following session, we had some nuns up here and talked to some people, some girls that were interested in being nuns. So you never know what our kids are interested in or may be interested in. So you want to give them an opportunity to if we can find the right person that will visit with them. And we've had lawyers and bankers and insurance people, business people that have their own businesses, restaurant owners, you name it. We've had them at these sessions to speak to our kids. And I think we do a heck of a job here with the Aldaretes and the Salazars and all these other individuals that volunteer so much of their time to try to keep our kids in school, because we're continuously fighting this dropout problem. But we're not winning, and we need more involvement from our parents at home. That's where it needs to start, and it's just not working right now.
Judge, thank you for your generous gift of time.
Sure.
This is your archive. Just a reminder that if you have any stuff stuffed away in the garage, under the bed, in boxes in the attic, send it to us at UT Arlington. This is your archive, and I will give you a form to execute as a needed gift when I remember to mail it to you.
Okay.
So, thank you.
I appreciate that, and I hope that was a